Welcome to this episode of Spinnaker Trust from the Helm. I'm Tim Melissa, Director of Portfolio Management. And as always, I'm joined by our Chief Investment Officer, Jessamine Norton, and our Director of Fixed Income and Alternatives, Evan Joes. In this episode, we will recap the choppy first quarter we saw in the markets. Then we will pivot to the second quarter outlook and focus on factors and indicators that we are looking for here at Spinnaker. Besides the coronavirus, there was a lot of news flow to digest in the first quarter, including President Trump signing a phase one trade deal with China, the UK finally Brexited, Joe Biden eventually took the lead in the Democratic primary, and Saudi Arabia started an oil price war with Russia. But before we get started, I wanted to remind everybody that we are all working remotely, so the quality of our audio may be affected. Thanks for understanding. Jessamine, can you set the stage as to where we were at the beginning of the year to where we are at the end of the first quarter from equity market perspective?
Sure, Tim. Thanks. And I'm actually going to take it back a little bit further to bring our listeners back to the end of 2018, where the market dropped nearly 20% in the month of December, which set the stage for a really positive 2019 that saw the S&P 500 rise by 31%, which was, you know, not unprecedented, but very surprising. And most notably, the market was up about 19% in the months of October, November, and December last year. So we came into 2020 in rip-roaring fashion. And the beginning of the year was largely a continuation of last year. Markets were strong. The same stocks were leading. And we were pretty positive on markets. We thought that there had been some temporary weakness due to the trade war with China. And after having signed the phase one agreement, that would start to iron itself out. This was all before the coronavirus kind of came up. And so we ended the first quarter of 2020 with the S&P down about 20%. We had international markets down more than that. And the market reached its all-time high on February 19th at a level of about S&P 3,380 or so. And our most recent bottom was on Monday, March 23rd, at a level of about 2,190. So since that point, which of course is after the end of the first quarter, we've retraced that move and the market is up about 50% from its bottom. So it's been wild. And then this type of shutdown of the economy is completely unprecedented. So it's been difficult to revisit previous recessions and try to use those as a template.
Great. Thank you, Jessamine. And Evan, can you touch base or give an update on the energy markets? What happened to energy in the first quarter?
Yeah, sure, Tim. So we came into the year with supply and demand relatively balanced. Oil was trading between $50 and $60 a barrel. And then we started to see it slide as coronavirus took hold in China and then into Europe. And investors started to worry about the demand side of things. While that was happening, OPEC got together, the oil production cartel, and many expected them to cut production. Well, the opposite happened. Russia and Saudi Arabia walked away from the table and actually decided to increase production, entering into a price war. And the result of that was energy prices falling by 30% over the course of two trading days. And then as COVID-19 took hold in the United States, it fell even further, down to, I think it bottomed in the low 20s. And now it's still hovering in that area now for oil per barrel. And, you know, right now oil is getting hit from both sides, the supply and the demand. U.S. shale, which has been the big story in oil the last decade, on the supply side is in a bit of trouble. The break even in shale is between $45 and $55 per barrel. And so they won't be able to hold on too long here and in the 20s. So we're watching that. We also have a longer term movement away from energy via ESG that a lot of investors are now just taking energy out of their portfolios completely. as they don't see the need for it in there. It's a small part of the S&P, and obviously there's strong feelings about how its effect on the environment. So oil and energy stocks had a rough first quarter.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate that. Jessamyn, we saw wild swings in price movements over the quarter. I think like March, the average price movement of the S&P 500 was about 5% or so. Can you talk a little bit about the swings and volatility that we saw?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So in any recessionary period or in any major pullback in the market, we see correlations of all asset classes basically go to one, which makes diversification very difficult in that type of environment. So as you made mention of, we saw the market, the average move in the market was 5%, whether it be up or down during the month of March, and that's a record. We also hit a record VIX level, so the VIX simply measures volatility, and that record was 84 or 86, I believe, that was hit in mid-March. So that is the worst VIX we've ever had, including during the global financial crisis. And so it was a wild one. And I think we've talked a lot about how the market investor structure is much different now than it was 10 years ago. And what we mean by that is that quantitative-oriented traders make up 70 to 80% of the daily volumes in the markets. And so the thresholds and the things that they use are very important to follow, even though that's not our style of investing. If that moves the market, then we need to be aware of it. So there is a strategy called risk parity, or otherwise known as volatility targeting. And that's gotten very, very big and popular over the last decade. And Ray Dalio and Bridgewater are kind of the poster children for that strategy. And of course, they've become very big and made a lot of money. The concept of that is that you balance the risk in your portfolio. So for example, generally bonds have lower risk as measured by standard deviation than equities. So you would try to have equal risk in your portfolio. But what these strategies do is that they lever up the bond part of the portfolio. And this works, especially when interest rates are falling and equities are rising. It's the perfect strategy in that environment, which means that it's done incredibly well for the last 3 or 4 years. What happened during March is that as interest rates continued to fall, the leveraging of bonds it no longer worked, frankly. So we saw this strategy dump all assets, gold, commodities, bonds, and equities at the same time. So it was striking to watch it all happen. It's probably will go down as one of those really memorable things in my career. As far as we can see, we believe that they have fully de-risked at this point and are reassessing their strategies. And so that, I think that has a lot to do with what happened in March. And the VIX is still pretty high. It's in the low 40s, but as I mentioned, it's come down from the low 80s. And generally, markets are thought to be much more stable when the VIX is at 30 or below. So we're hopeful that that might happen in the next month or two, and we'll look for that. So it was wild. The month of March may be the most wild month of my career.
So many people are saying that this is potentially the Great Depression Part 2. Will this be another Great Depression?
Yeah, I can start in on that, Tim. And obviously, things don't look very good right now. Over the last few weeks, the unemployment claims have been the highest in history on a weekly basis. Unemployment is projected right now to, come close to 20%, but it could easily exceed that. Many businesses are obviously most businesses, small businesses especially, are closed right now and will remain closed for the foreseeable future. And it remains to be seen whether they'll be able to reopen and rehire their workers. So with all that in mind, trying to compare it to the depression of the early 30s, there are a lot of similarities with the unemployment situation. But the big difference is the government reaction to the coronavirus in the United States has been huge so far. It's already larger than the entire stimulus program put in place after the last recession. And there are many different programs available for employees, unemployed, people, businesses, small and large, monetary policy, and fiscal stimulus is in place. And it's also being coordinated on a global basis because the coronavirus is a global pandemic. So you have Europe fighting it the same way we are. China's doing their part. So with that coordination, it's very different than what happened in the United States in the early 30s, where actually it was a very different situation in some ways as well, because they had runaway inflation at that time. So the government was actually raising taxes on imports and tightening monetary policy and liquidity, where it's the exact opposite reaction now. So while we don't think this is the Great Depression Part 2, due to these reasons, it is early and in this fight against the coronavirus, and it's yet to be seen what the economic fallout will ultimately be.
I'd just add a few things to that, namely that the stimulus coming out of the U.S. is at this point 20% of GDP when you combine fiscal and monetary stimulus. And most of the programs that we've been talking about are actually look as though they're going to get bigger. So we could get to 25 or 30% of GDP in terms of stimulus, which is incredible. The real question is how long the pandemic goes on for and how long small businesses have to have their doors closed, and then therefore how long people will be unemployed. It's really a question of timing, because the government very much, I think, learned from the financial crisis in 08 and 09. And, you might remember at that point, the original stimulus package, the TARP, did not pass, and the market went down 7 or 8% that day. I think our government has learned their lesson from that period and quickly pushed through this type of stimulus. So the government appears to be willing to borrow an unlimited amount to keep the economy going. And so we hope that it does. Based on the weekly unemployment claims, it seems like the unemployment rate right now is probably 12 or 13%. Most believe that the unemployment claims will weaken one more week, so that this Thursday we'll get worse data again, and that after that we may see a big drop off. So perhaps the unemployment rate gets to 15. And then after that, it's really about timing and when we can open the economy back up and hopefully get everyone back to work. And as Evan mentioned, we don't have any clarity on that at this point.
Thank you for both your comments on that. Evan, switching gears a little bit, we talked a little bit about the equity markets, how they performed in the first quarter. Can you touch base on the fixed income markets for us?
Yeah, sure. So, the story of the last few decades has been rates have been falling. That was what happened in 2019. And we came into 2020 with the 10-year Treasury rate, which is kind of a benchmark rate for all rates, at 1.9%, give or take a bit, and it continued to decline. So it's been the same story. When a lot of people thought at the beginning of the year we were going to have a little bit better growth that might lead to a bit of inflation, it turned out to be the opposite case with the coronavirus coming on so strong across the world. And as a result, the 10-year Treasury actually dipped to a record low of about 30 basis points, the yield on the 10-year Treasury rate. And it now is at about 70, 75. And we really expect that to stay in a pretty tight range, assuming that there's no quick resolution to the coronavirus, as the Fed has dropped the Fed funds rate to zero, the tremendous amount of monetary policy in the system. And so we think treasuries are obviously very rich here relative to history, but possibly not for this scenario. We also saw in investment grade corporates and high yield, we saw spreads widen out. They didn't get to levels seen during the last recession, but they did widen out quite a bit off record low spreads. And those have actually come back in as the Fed declared that they would now be buying investment grade corporate bonds and even some high yield bonds, specifically the fallen angels. So there was a huge number of triple B rated bonds. It's been talked about for several years now in the market. And, the result of that, what would happen when we go into recession for all those triple B rated bonds.
times when they got downgraded to high yield. What would be the result of that? And the Fed decided that it would step in and start buying those and really provided a backstop for investment grade and high yield corporate bonds, that entire market. So it seems like the Fed is out to provide as much liquidity as possible. They want to keep everything going. And the bond market has taken that and run with it. And actually, spreads have come back in a little bit off those lows that we saw in mid-March.
So you guys both mentioned policy efforts. The Senate and the House passed the CARES Act. Can you go over some of the highlights for us?
Sure, I'll start, and then Eben can take the baton. I think the highlight of the CARES Act has been what they're calling the PPP program. So it's offering forgivable loans, if the company plays their cards right, to encourage small businesses, those with fewer than 500 employees, to keep their employees on the payroll for 2 months. So your workers cannot be furloughed. And it also, I believe, 75% of the PPP goes toward employee salaries, and the remainder can be used for things like rent and utilities. But it's really meant to keep employees on the payroll. And it's been incredibly popular. We've read stories about record loan applications. Companies can apply through their banks. And we believe that the size of that program will be enhanced. There's a lot of demand for it. And so that's pretty revolutionary and creative. We've never had anything like that that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and in addition to that, the federal government has increased the unemployment insurance by $600 per week for those folks on unemployment. You know, they've also, obviously, everybody you know, in the United States is getting a check in the mail from the Treasury, depending on how much money you make and how many children you have. And then they're doing a lot on the business side of things. You know, in addition to the small business lending, they're also trying to provide as much liquidity to large businesses, you know, via vehicles that can buy, like I said, corporate bonds, investment grade and high yield. They're also going to be supplying cash grants to industries that have been hard hit by this crisis, such as airlines. So they're basically through all of these programs trying to provide as much liquidity as possible. And I think it's working, based on the market reaction and the functionality in the market. It seems to be having the right effect so far. It's early, but so far it seems to be working.
Thank you for that. And guys, with all the volatility that's been happening, there was a famous quote by Rahm Emanuel, where he said, never let a crisis go to waste. What does this mean, and what has Spinnaker done to reposition our portfolios?
Right, I'll take that one. So it feels like a crude thing to say, given the circumstances. But, you know, if you are an investor and this type of situation arises, generally there are a lot of opportunities that emerge if you are ready for them and well-positioned. So in our equity portfolios, where we own single stocks, we made a lot of what we believe are upgrades. So there are a number of stocks and businesses that we've wanted to hold for a long time, but we could never get enough upside to our target prices or a margin of safety. The margin of safety was inadequate. And so finally, these businesses came down to a level where we were ready to buy them. And our team did a great job of doing some really quick work, or having already done the work on these businesses, we were ready to go. And so we were able to upgrade those portfolios into names that we have always wanted to hold and plan to hold for a long time. And at the same time, we upgraded the ESG rating of our portfolio. We use MSCI ratings to assess our own portfolios, and we were able to move up by a substantial amount for our two stock picking portfolios, which was great. For our ETF strategies, we were able to enact kind of a similar process where we were able to take losses in certain holdings and move toward more of a core and satellite model of execution. This is something that we had already been running in the international and fixed income portion of our ETF strategy. So we were able to move to that within equities. And we were also able to take on an ESG core there. So we are using targeted ESG ETFs as the core of our portfolios, which is something we've been wanting to do. It aligns with our Spinnaker values, and it generally aligns with our client values. So we're pretty happy about having upgraded all of our portfolios. It was a ton of work, especially since we were all at home and unable to communicate as easily as we normally do. But we feel as though all of our portfolios are really well positioned for the future. You know, if the market continues to go down or flatlines here, the quality in our portfolio is much improved, which means that the stocks and the ETFs we own have a higher threshold for pain, if you will. And if the market goes up we're in some of the best business models that we want to be in for the long term. So there is a silver lining to everything that happened, and I'm very happy with how our portfolios are positioned today.
And I know some of the clients that I have spoken to over the phone are really excited about the changes we've made. So kind of switching gears and looking a little bit towards the rest of 2020, where do we think the bottom is for the markets, and what factors or indicators are we following or looking for?
So I'll take that. I think the biggest indicator we're looking for is some kind of resolution to the health crisis. And obviously that's really hard to forecast. A vaccine, which would be the ultimate resolution, is probably at least a year out. There are several treatments that are in trials right now that may have some effect that could help things proceed. But we're looking for something on that front, and I think that's the most important. And you've seen, you know, the market has come back a little bit on the news that the number of infections in hotspots like New York City has started to plateau and even decline a bit. So you can tell that is the number one indicator the market's looking for. But I'll let Justin discuss some of the other things we look at.
Right. So that is clearly what Evan mentioned is the most important indicator. So if we know that the major cities in the U.S. probably have already plateaued, and we expect the entire country to be plateauing right around now. I believe the more rural states are expected to plateau at the very end of April. So we're in the midst of that. The next question is really, when can our economy open up again and normalize? We've seen Trump make a lot of noise about opening back up, and he's put together a task force to do so. So it'll be very interesting as to whether we can open up or not. And as Evan mentioned, it's very difficult to forecast. But aside from those really important fundamental issues, I've found in the past during recessions and periods like this, fundamentals in terms of looking at earnings and company guidance are completely useless. For instance, right now, the sell side, which maintains consensus earnings estimates, is woefully behind. Most haven't even touched their numbers over the last month. So for analysts and portfolio managers who actually invest real money, using that as a resource is fruitless. So you have to be more creative and ignore earnings in 2020. So we focused on the long-term aspects of the companies we invest in, but we're also looking at technical indicators quite a bit. So you know, there's reason to believe, based on a concept called Brett thrust, that the market has already bottomed. And that's meant to show, it was because 3 days in a row, 95% of stocks were going down. And historically, that's marked a bottom. So we'll see if the market environment is different this time around. But that's something that we're looking at. We're also watching sentiment and positions and positioning very closely. So we're able to see with a bit of a lag how hedge funds are positioned, how retail investors are positioned, where they're putting their money incrementally. And it seems as though institutional investors and retail investors have been running for the hills. The flows into money markets are very, very high. Sentiment is terrible. Institutional investors appear to have totally mitigated all risk and are sitting on the sidelines. So if you have no one left to sell, it's difficult to figure out how much the market might go down. So we tend to rely on technical indicators and sentiment indicators more than fundamental indicators. And I would say that the first stage of the bear market is over. We had that dumping that we alluded to in March, and the Brett thrust threshold has been met. And so we've already had a massive retest. As I mentioned, we're up 50% or so from the bottom today. So the question is really, do we go down and retest that 2190 level, or do we just keep going higher or somewhere in between? So we are looking at short-term indicators, and we believe the bottom may be in.
Eben, what are our thoughts on inflation and gold as we head into the second quarter?
Yeah, I guess I'll start with inflation. You know, a lot of investors have been looking for inflation over the last few years, and the Fed has been trying to create inflation for many years, and it just hasn't happened. And there's been many reasons for that, including demographics, the technological change, it's increased productivity. But right now, in the current situation, it's hard to imagine inflation being a problem for at least a year or two, even when you consider the amount of monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus coming into the system globally. Because you just have that the demand side of it is such an unknown right now. And even if something, there is a development on curing the coronavirus or at least, something that allows the economy to reopen to some extent, it's hard to believe that having hit these levels of unemployment, even for a short period of time, that consumers that are the primary driver of at least the United States economy are going to be willing to go out and spend like they were before the coronavirus hit. So I think it's a tough to imagine a lot of inflation coming through the system. On gold, we've held gold in our portfolios for a little over a year. We put it in there because we thought it was a good late cycle hedge, and we thought that real rates were likely going to head lower as growth was going to be harder to come by. So we've had gold in the portfolio for a while. We still think it plays a role in our portfolios, even though it's we're effectively, like Justin has said, we may have already hit the low. And as far as it being a hedge against a flight to safety type asset, we still think it has a place, especially when you have this issue of all this monetary and fiscal stimulus coming into the system. Will that lead to a lot of inflation down the road? There's certainly a question out there, and I think investors are thinking that gold might be a good thing to have in the portfolio, at least for the foreseeable future. Jasmine, do you agree?
Yes, I do. And I'd mention one other thing on inflation. No one knows why inflation has been so subpar for the last decade. There are many theories out there. One of them is that globalization has become en vogue. So every large company in America has moved their supply chain overseas. No one makes anything in America anymore. And after this experience and what we had and the situation with China and the trade war last year, I think it's safe to say that a lot of companies will be moving their supply chain, certainly out of China. That's already happened, but may move their supply chain back to the U.S. or closer to the U.S., perhaps in Mexico. But if you're unable to harvest the lower costs that come with massive outsourcing, if you effectively unwind globalization, that's a multi-year, maybe multi-decade story, but that does suggest that there may be some pent-up inflation in the system.
Thank you for listening to our quarterly review and outlook episode of Spinnaker Trust from the Helm. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating and follow us on LinkedIn. And as always, please feel free to reach out to us with any questions. Thanks again. And talk soon.